Welcome to Liberties Talk, the podcast of Liberties Journal. I'm Celeste Marcus, managing editor of Liberties and the host of this podcast, on which we talk with our writers and the wider Liberty Circle about whatever is on our minds. This episode of the podcast is a special one. It is the first salon of a series of salons that we will be doing every month with Interintellect. Either I or Leon will host one of our writers. The structure is pretty much the same as a Liberties Talk podcast. We just talk with our writer for the first 30 to 45 minutes, but this time it's on Zoom. And it is open to anyone who'd like to come. So you can come listen to us talk for the first 30 to 45 minutes. And then after that, we just open it up to Q&A. And you can ask us whatever questions you have, share whatever thoughts you had about the conversation. The first episode was with Benjamin Moser. And the subject was his new book, The Upside Down World, which I've been waiting to read for as long as I've known Ben. And rightly, it is an incredible book. And I loved talking to Ben about it. And I loved hearing all of the questions from the listeners who had come onto the Zoom at the end of the conversation. I hope that you enjoy the talk as much as I did, and I do hope that you will join us for future ones. If you are a Liberties subscriber, we will email you the coupon code to get a ticket for free a few days before the salon. If you are not a Liberties subscriber, but you enjoy this podcast, then head over to libertiesjournal.com when you're finished listening to it and correct that condition.
Hi, everyone.
Hello, everyone. How exciting. Okay, so I just want to thank first Interintellect. I'm so excited that we get to do these salons every month. This is the first of a series of salons that Liberties will be doing with one of our writers once a month, beginning of every month. I hope that you enjoy this one. I hope you come back. I am so delighted that Ben is going to be our first guest. And that the subject of this first salon is his book, The Upside Down World, which I have been waiting to read since I met him, and he took a damn long time finishing it. Actually, I only had to wait 3 years. He had to wait 20 years to finish it. So the book, I guess, a really insufficient summary or characterization of the book is that it is 17 portraits of artists of the Dutch Golden Age. Each chapter is a different painter. And it is much more than that, but it is also that. And you really do, Ben has this passage towards the end of the book where he's describing the feeling of having gone to a museum and looked at every painting, read every description, listened to your audio guide, like tried your best to absorb all of this information, and you go home exhausted, your eyes are bleeding and your head is spinning, and you've just like tried to just ingest all of this information. And I don't feel quite like that after having finished Ben's book, but I feel a little. It's a lot. Person who goes to a museum typically like becomes familiar with an artist by spending time with their paintings. At least that's how I do it. I don't usually read books about a painter until I've had time to spend with their work first. So this is really the first time that I've ever had someone give me so many at a time. And it really is so exciting how much Ben knows and how much he is able to characterize people. But it is also about more than just art. And one has the sense while reading it that Ben is, I kept thinking of the term like exactingly humanistic, just every realm of his life. He is so hard on himself about like wringing every possible human experience for wisdom and insight. And what I mean by that, I think is best explained by having Ben read something from the book. So I sent him one of my favorite passages, and I'm just going to ask that he read it.
Okay, let me pull it up here really quickly. Thank you, first of all, for saying that, and thank you for reading it, because you're pretty much the first person outside of my immediate world of family and publishers who's read it. So, all right, so here's the thing that Celeste wanted me to read, and we can talk about it. I say, I have written two biographies of famously beautiful women, Clarissa Spector and Susan Sontag, and was always fascinated by the ways their beauty was written about. and spoken of by the people I interviewed. Maybe it's the word beautiful that has been worn down by overuse. But when I looked at them, and when you write a biography, you look at them for years on end, I saw something that wasn't quite beauty. Both were intensely aware of what it meant to be a beautiful woman, or a woman perceived as beautiful. Both wrote about how beauty could make or break, make and break, a woman's life. Both knew that no matter how much we might pretend it doesn't matter what we look like, there's nothing superficial about hair and clothes and makeup, the whole delicate edifice of personal appearance. And in the supposedly serious world I inhabited, which is Celeste and Leon, you know, there was a reluctance to talk about beauty. It was fine for superficial materialistic women, or maybe your gay hairdresser, to care about what they looked like. But I often met the suggestion that it wasn't quite appropriate to discuss it in connection with the towering minds of women like my subjects. Never mind that they themselves, and indeed nearly all great women writers, knew how profound the question was. I knew it was a lie that beauty was superficial. And just as I had learned in biographical research to pay careful attention to lies, because everybody lies about something different, and because lies always point to some deeper truth, I began to scrutinize my subjects and realize that neither was conventionally beautiful. Often enough in pictures, they both usually looked awkward and uncomfortable, yet people perceive them as beautiful.
So the thing that, the quality that you're talking about that you say is not quite beauty, what you say later that it is charisma, which is a quality that it's really hard to write about because usually it's, you know that it's there because you have a visceral response to the thing that you're looking at. And it's clear you wrote this book because you just moved to a new country and you were trying to, I think you were trying to develop an identity. Is that fair? A fair characterization of what it was?
Yeah. So I moved to this country 20 plus years ago in 2002, 21 years ago. And I found myself in a country that is more of a beer country than a wine country, if you know what I mean. It's sort of a Northern European, practical, you know, people are not super refined. They're actually kind of rude. They're sort of proud of this. They'll tell you this. And they're not, it's not Italy, you know, it's not France. It's not really that aspirational in a certain way. So it doesn't really hold out a sense of who you can be or what you should be. You know, you move to Rome and you're going to become an artist. You move to Paris and you're going to become a philosopher. You know, here, it's not that thing. So I just kind of fell into this world that I didn't expect. I call it the upside down world. It's an old Dutch expression. It means everything's the wrong way around. And I discovered these museums, and you know, you and I have visited some of the museums here together. And when you go into these museums, you walk out of this practical sort of nation of shopkeepers, and you walk into this completely fascinating world. And the question about you know, holding onto your identity becomes: what do you want to see here? Do you want to see the grocery store and the traffic jam and all that and the bad politicians, which this country has like every other country? Or do you want to find something really beautiful? And what you find, and this is why I write so much about beauty and charisma, is something that becomes almost, it makes you high. It gives you something chemical in your brain that is really hard to identify. It's the same Stendhal syndrome that he describes when people will come over the Alps, you know, from Germany or Holland or England or France, and they'll arrive in Florence and they're completely overwhelmed by something. And if you know Italy also, you know that it gets really addictive. Like when I spent a few months in Venice, and every day I would get up and think, what soul-destroying masterpiece am I going to see before I have my coffee this morning? You know, like there's so much and it comes at you so intensely. Yeah. And so, and then you try to come to terms with it in your own way. And that's what I tried to do here, but it was a very different kind of, it was a very different kind of culture.
Yeah. I mean, it seems as if just from reading the book, it doesn't seem like you had a hard time, finding people who changed the way that you looked at the world. I mean, these are artists that you mastered them, but they also in some ways mastered you, every one of them. is that, I mean,
yeah,
that's certainly the impression.
Well, you look at them, you try to learn something from them. There's certain, I just went to a show today. It was really an interesting show about Dutch painters in Rome in the early 17th century. And it was really interesting that you can come across all these people and they come across really as people. You know, they actually show up and they have something to say to you if you want to listen to them. And that sounds a little bit spooky and earth mothery or something, but it's not. I mean, there really is a lot you can learn. Like in the second or third chapter, I talk about what is an artist? And this is about two pupils of Rembrandt, Ferdinand Bol and Govert Flink, who were considered great, great artists and who then get completely trashed by the beginning of the 20th century because they don't respond to an idea of art that comes 200 years later. So you're always asking, and I was starting out as a writer, I was trying to figure out, like, what am I doing here? Who am I? Why am I? What am I doing? What is writing about? And I did. I looked to them as teachers.
Right. It's interesting. I loved, one of the things that I loved about your book, which I think is really rare, is that you refer to yourself as an artist, which writers don't typically do, just very naturally, not even like you're making a point about it. You say, I am an artist, like these men, except for one, there is a woman, were artists. And I guess I think I might know what you mean by that, but could you just say what it is that you meant by that?
Well, I think it's a word that would embarrass anyone, wouldn't it? I mean, artist, usually, unless you're like a painter, it seems, but you know, you're trying to create something. Let's just put it that way. Whatever it is, whether it's ceramics or poetry or something. And it's a word that I don't think I was ready to use for myself at that point when I started writing, when I came here, but I was aware of myself as trying to be something better than I was supposed to be in a way, which is something that can be derided as aspirational, as it often is now, because you're not supposed to actually care about stuff or try that hard. But, you know, but I was trying really hard, and I did have a very exalted sense of calling and of, and I found these artists, I was touched by their struggles, by their failures. A lot of them died quite young. I mean, you know, I'm 3 years yeah. older than Vermeer was when he died. And a lot of them were younger than he was. So that forces you to ask the question, you know, what do I want to do with myself? What am I, why I'm not here for that long? How can I make the most out of what gifts I have?
Yeah, it's one of the sentences that recurs the most throughout the book. Maybe it's not the same sentence, but it's that they all die so young. And the other one is yeah. that nothing is known about this person. You say that yeah. you say that in like every single chapter, and then you go on, there's like this outpouring of information about this man you just said no one knows anything about, which is, it's the book does not feel burdened with scholarship because you make so much exciting, so many characters. I mean, a lot of the artists in the book are not people that most of us would have heard of. I mean, we've right. heard of Rembrandt and Vermeer and Hals, but I mean, maybe we've heard of some of the other ones, but we don't know them that well. You've spent so much time just amassing all of this information, and you weren't doing it initially to write a book, right? It was kind of like this compulsion that you had to find yeah. out these people. You don't really write about that. What was that? What's wrong with you?
Well, I mean, listen, the painters are the great glory of this country. You know, like when you go to Germany is a country that's about music. You know, France might be a country about food. I don't know. I mean, Italy is a country about everything. You know, if you go to Greece, you become interested in the archaeology and the classical phase. So this was really the great thing in Holland. And I became totally fascinated by it. The thing is, though, you know, there's a whole industry that has been going strong for 200 years almost of art history, which is the same, it comes from the same instinct that Darwin classifies all the finches, you know, or you know, this is this 19th century positive science that's still how a lot of our history is written today. It's a lot about attributing this to that and X-raying it so that you can see the finger was here, but then he moved it to here. And, you know, it's really boring, actually, a lot of it. It's kind of like insufferably tedious, a lot of our historical scholarship. But, you know, through it, it's how you get to know something. And it's actually, it often looks like more than it is. You know, a lot of these people, their work might be known, but like who they really were personally, you just have to kind of feel it and learn as much as you can. But still, the work has to come first.
Well, it sounds, you write about this, I think, once, and it's, I think every chapter or most of the chapters begins with a story that's not directly about the subject of the chapter, right? I mean, some of them are just about you, but some of them are not about you at all. Some of them are about some surprising thing that will later have to do with the subject. And I think in the beginning of one of the chapters, you're talking about how boring you find it to read monographs. Typically, monographs are like the most boring thing you can read.
They're really boring.
I guess because they're the work of an obsessive, like you just, you know that you're being given all of these facts that are not necessarily relevant to the work. Is that what you mean by boring?
I mean, boring, like they're tedious to read. I mean, a lot of them really, like they'll be like this nail in the canvas in the back, you know, they did, it has like 42.3% titanium, which means that it was from the Baltic region. I mean, you know, you just think, Jesus, people, give me a break. But, and it's written in a way, this is another thing that our history has, it's from its origins as a 19th century science, is that it's written in a sort of scientific way that often in a lot of cultural scholarship, whether it's in literature or art, to kind of tamps it down. You know, it kind of, it's skeptical of emotion, it's skeptical of concepts like beauty, charisma. It doesn't want to say, isn't it so sad that this guy died? You know, that doesn't sound serious. And I think that, you know, at this point, one of the really interesting things about art history and art scholarship is that we do know a lot more than we used to. And so once you have all that stuff, then the critic can come in, you know, the writer can come in and try to say, okay, the nail is from wherever, but, what does it mean? And what does it do to me? And why should people care about it now?
So you decided that you had to ingest all of these tedious sources, because the thing that the Dutch have is their painting, and you wanted to get at the soul of the country. And this seemed like the only way for you to do that.
It was the way that I was most interested in. I mean, you can go at all sorts of other ways. One thing I did write is that at the very beginning, I paid attention to all the news and I knew everything about every horrible politician, and, you know, and it kind of drove me crazy because I know all that about my own country. And that is, you know, God knows enough already. Do I need to hear about the sort of, you know, proto-fascist rebrand over here? And, no, I just was fascinated by it. And I just was really, it's so appealing when you go to the Dutch museums, or you go to the Dutch galleries in other countries, of which there are endless quantities of them. You see how this little country of 1 million people produced one of these great moments in human cultural achievement. And so I thought it was natural to be attracted to it.
And do you feel like, did you feel while you were sort of cataloging all of these painters that there was a through line? I thought that the genre painting would be sort of the centerpiece of the book, but it's really not. I mean, it's, that's sort of the kind of painting that I associate with the Dutch Golden Age. Right. Was that for you? Did it change the way that you looked at painting? It's held out as this revolutionary thing because suddenly people were, well, I guess, say what a genre painting is and then talk about what its role was.
Well, in the book, I say, you know, Don Quixote is published in 1606, which is considered the first modern novel. And that's, as we've read it, it's not really actually about anything. I mean, there's a story, but it kind of goes on and on and on. And it kind of is whatever he wants it to be about. And this is something that was a revolution in literature. And it becomes a revolution in painting too, which is that you don't have to have a mythological scene. It doesn't have to be something from the Bible. It doesn't have to be something celebrating some ruler. It can just be a girl with a pearl earring. That can be a painting. Now that was a real intellectual and cultural revolution. And so when you find the range of what people do, it starts about a generation after Cervantes, that people start making, the painting about anything. Yeah. You have this incredible collection of people, and not everybody has to be a Vermeer or a Rembrandt. A lot of people are really good at painting, like, you know, fish or churches or whatever. I mean, you know, you can just do, and you see a range of human possibility and human intellectual creativity just exploding, and it's extremely exciting.
There were other examples of paintings that you talk about in the book that were as earth-shattering as the genre painting, like, for example, the still life, which I didn't realize was such a modern invention. And you talk about, yeah. Is it Cort? Is that how you pronounce his name?
Cort.
I'm going to pronounce all these names. Okay.
It's okay.
Yeah. So what was, I guess one question, which is sort of an obvious one, is how did you decide who gets in and who didn't get in?
Well, so most people don't get in, right? I mean, it's kind of long, actually. It's not that short, the book, but it feels short to me.
17 is a significant, anyway. It felt long.
Yeah, it's a lot.
I felt like I'd absorbed a lot.
No, but I mean, it's, you know, and I think a lot of it's new to people, especially people, I think even here in the Netherlands, people don't assume that people know anything about their own culture, I don't think, in any country. That's usually a losing assumption. But I decided just, you know what it really was just people who did something interesting and who I was personally curious about. And so the still life, when you look into this seems really obvious, right? You have a peach, you have a glass of wine, there's your picture, right? But in fact, the Romans painted still lifes in their villas. So you can still see them in Pompeii, but they disappear along with portraits and landscapes. So for example, there's no portrait even of Charlemagne. There's no portrait in the West for 1,000 years. There's images of people, but they don't have the portrait
it's
quality,
an image.
Which is, no, well, I mean, they're just a head, you know. But like this says, this is Celeste Marcus. That's a portrait. And that actually, landscape, still life, and portraiture all emerge in different parts of Europe in the same few years, which is between 1340 and 1350. Some in France, some in the Netherlands, and some in Italy. And it's this revolution. And you see a still life, this seems so obvious, but when you read and you study and you learn about what a still life is, and what an expansion of human possibility that represents, you just, the little peach becomes something completely different.
One of the interesting things that you learn from reading the book is who taught whom. So yeah. Rembrandt taught, oh God, how do you pronounce his name?
Leavens. Bol and Flink.
More, the one who also taught Vermeer.
Fabricius,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So all of these, there were apprenticeships, but there weren't museums, right? I mean, there wasn't a place.
No.
So how was their influence between countries, if there was?
So the first real museum that emerges in the West is the Louvre, which is created in 1793 out of the Palace of the Kings of France when the Royal Art Collections become the National Art Collections. And this is an incredibly shocking idea because usually paintings are either in private homes and not necessarily aristocratic or royal homes. A lot of people have paintings, middle-class people, or they're in churches. And the idea that you can present art as art becomes really revolutionary. And actually one of the very early European museums is the Tyler's Museum in Haarlem with two A's, in where we went to see Frans Hals. And that starts all over Europe. In the 17th century, people saw paintings basically in homes, but artists also collected. Rembrandt was a great collector. And Rembrandt, at the height of his wealth and opulence, had a huge art collection. And so his students, of whom there were very many, and I write about a few of them, and I write about that genealogy that goes from him to Vermeer and then onwards, they would all see these things. So, for example, I write about the dirty feet of the Madonna of the Rosary, which is now in Vienna, but it was actually here in the Netherlands during the time of Rembrandt. So the idea that you could have dirty feet in a painting of the Virgin was really shocking. And the Dutch just went to town with that. They loved that. So it was very personal and it was very direct.
One of the oldest continuous art museum in the country is the Wadsworth Atheneum in our country, right. The Wadsworth, yeah. Which you write about in the book. Yeah, you and your sister went there. I forget who you was it Bol?
De Hoogh. No, Peter De Hoogh.
I'm glad that I didn't try to do that one.
Yeah.
So
it's a Hebrew ch, you can do it.
I just do that
Hoogh, part. Hoogh, yeah.
We'll go through it next week when you
see right, them. All right, all right.
So I know that I sound like a sophisticated individual, but
okay.
You say in this passage that you decided that you were just going to go to like every museum, every exhibition that you could, because you thought that your art history education was deficient. And it seems as if this became of vital importance to you, that you actually go see as many paintings as possible. And not just that you go see the paintings in person, but then you also go and see the places that they were painted of. So we find you like in various parts of the planet looking at the landscapes that these people painted. Where did this compulsion come from? Did somebody tell you that you were supposed to be an adventurer, that was part of being a humanist? You certainly seem to
hit it. This is like the why you become a biographer, right? Because you want to know where they went to seventh grade, you know? It's not totally normal, but it's actually really interesting. And, you know, I write about Robert Caro saying, turn every page. And I say, go everywhere. Because you never know what it's going to turn up. A lot of times as a biographer and also in this book, I've flown off to something and it was completely nothing and it was a waste of money and time and it made me depressed and I felt angry and resentful that I had shown up. And other times, and this is also true when you interview people, you know, the famous person you've really tried hard to interview is a complete zero. And the lady who lived in the apartment across the hall in 1958 is the really interesting woman that like is going to tell you everything. So you never really know. But my compulsion, I mean, I graduated from college in 1998 and I felt like, okay, that was great. But I'm not an academic. I don't want to keep doing it in that way, but I want to keep learning and I want to keep educating myself. And I was living in New York and I just went to every show I could. And that was one of them. And that was where I felt the charm of the Dutch home, you know, because De Hoogh is a painter of happy families and of these beautiful houses. And it's extremely seductive. And he actually figures this out before Vermeer does, and Vermeer was his neighbor.
So cool that you know that. So you, what did you major in college? Is it related to art history, or did you major in language?
I majored in history. That was like the most, I really wanted to major in Portuguese, but I sort of thought that was a little bit too much to ask my parents, and history sounded like a little more normal. But no, I went to Brown, you know, and the reason I went to Brown is I liked studying just whatever I wanted to study. And, you know, at the time it was pretty unusual to be able to go somewhere where you didn't have any requirements outside of your major. So I thought I could study whatever I wanted to.
And then when did you decide that you had to learn as many languages as possible?
Well, that was natural in a way. By the time I got to college, I really only knew three languages. Which were French and Spanish and English, and German a little bit. I mean, not great, but what you realize if you study languages is that they're not that hard.
It's an annoying thing to say.
Well, okay. So once you learn French and Spanish, can you learn Italian and Portuguese? Yes, it's not rocket science. Like if you're going to learn Korean and Arabic, okay, that's hard. But if you know the German and the Latin dialects. Like if you know German, it's not that hard to learn Dutch. It's not that hard to learn the Scandinavian languages. I learned Yiddish based on German when I did my first book. It's a sort of muscle that I think you can exercise or not. And it's brought me a lot of great stuff in my life.
I ask because a language is a door into a different culture. And that seems to be one of your fetishes, is just kind of discovering other ones and mastering them. And you write in the very end of the book, the afterwards, about coming back to Texas, which is not a place that appears very often in the book, which surprised me because so much of you is in it. I guess it's a more intimate thing to betray things about yourself by writing about the things that are most important to you than directly writing about yourself. So I came away with as deep an understanding of you as I had of any of the people that you wrote about, though you didn't, I don't know if you intended to do that. But at the end of the book, you say that you were very proud when you came home, you were very proud to realize that you had an identity that was not inherited, that you'd built it for yourself. And do you?
Yeah. I mean, I came from a very comfortable place. You know, I came from America at the height of its imperial power. I had every advantage of culture and economics and education and everything that you could have. And I was I was a perfect citizen of New York City. I mean, I really was. And it was great. It was great. But I felt like if I stay here, I can kind of see where this is going. And I don't necessarily want to see where it's going. I want to take risks and I want to learn new things. And I want to do things like you're saying, you know, kind of stretch my legs and learn, keep learning. I guess that was the thing, not become static. Is that the word? You know, like stuck in a rut, like happened. Yeah. And that is very hard. And you know, that story about how I go back to Houston right before the pandemic. And I think, what the hell was I thinking? Like, why did I make this so hard for myself? Like, I could have lived a great life beneath the spreading oak trees of Houston. Mm-hmm. And instead, but I did it. I don't know. I mean, when you're young, you do stuff. It's kind of when I see 25-year-olds now, they look like babes in arms. But I didn't feel like a babe in arms when I was 25. I mean, I felt like I was up for taking a risk. And it was great. And it was, you know, the best thing I ever did. So
25 is about middle age for any of the artists that you write about.
Even old. I mean, like Potter dies at 27. Fabricius dies at 32.
They all have like 15 kids. It's terrifying.
They have a lot of kids and they all die. You know, half the kids die or 2/3 of the kids die.
Yeah.
It's really hard. I think one of the things that's fascinating about Dutch painting and studying and reading about it is that you think you see it. You don't think, if you look at some huge mosaic of angels on an Italian dome, you don't think, oh, I understand that, those people. You know, you can think it's beautiful and it's fun and it's interesting. But a lot of the big, like, the trick the Dutch play on you is that you think that you understand it. You think, oh, this is a girl in a living room. Well, you know, it's very hard to imagine if a girl is probably going to have 8 to 10 pregnancies and then die between the age of 30 and 40. Like, who is that girl? Like, what's her mental world? What is she? How does she live? It's you know, you think, and actually I live in this house, which you can't really, you can see a little of my library here, but like, but this is a house from 1600. And if you've been to Holland, you know that the cities still look exactly like they do in the paintings. Yeah. But the people are completely different. And so to try to think yourself into who they really were is a fascinating exercise.
You don't talk about your living neighbors very much in the book. You talk a lot about you try to imagine their ancestors, but you don't talk about them that much. I think that the person you mention, the person who kind of like looms over the whole book, I thought was Rembrandt. Is that because he really did have, was that because of his influence on you or because he really did just, he was just the giant of the period and everybody had to work through him?
Both. I mean, he's the giant. There's no question. I mean, if you think about, you know, the Vermeer show is on and all these people are coming to see it, including me. But, you know, Vermeer painted about 35 paintings. Rembrandt painted about 500. And, you know, there's, that doesn't include the drawings, the etchings, the everything, the all the influence that he had on all these other painters for generations and generations. And though there's a famous old book, kind of heated patriotic book called The Land of Rembrandt from the 30s. And it's sort of, you know, like Illinois is the land of Lincoln or, okay, well, but it turns out Holland really is the land of Rembrandt. And you realize that in the way that England is the land of Shakespeare, that these really great figures do end up coloring everything about the society far beyond what you would even suspect. And also Rembrandt is just a fascinating figure. And I wrote that piece, you know, that's in the book that first came out in Liberties about the theme of evil in Rembrandt, because that's something you really see comes up again and again. There's a darkness and a bloodiness and a murderousness and a rapiness to Rembrandt that is really, it's unique. There's no other painter that has that side of him in the same way that Shakespeare has that tragic side to him as well.
Does that bleed into the other artists of the period? I mean, there is, you write about darkness for some other people, but not the same.
Well, a lot of them try a lot. Sometimes it sneaks in, you know, and they don't really, I mean, Rembrandt is full on, right?
Yeah.
On the nose. Like De Hoogh, you know, there are these weird paintings at the end of his life that you'll hardly ever see because they're all in storage. He starts off his career with these absolutely beautiful, enchanting pictures of mothers and children and of the happy home and of the happy family and of love and peace. And he ends up with these pictures that are completely crazy and just hideous looking. And so all this art history and all this excavation, this 200 years of work shows that actually he ends up pretty much penniless, just churning stuff out. And so there's this huge tragedy that isn't actually said in the painting, but you can see it. You can just see it because the painting's kind of ugly.
Right. For Rembrandt, this is not my phrasing. You quote people as having said that it looks like it's such thick paint that it looks like crap. Okay. If you go to the Maurits House, which you write about a lot, which is this museum, is it in Rotterdam or is it?
The Hague.
The Hague. Yeah. There's one room with early Rembrandt and then another room with later Rembrandt. And then on the other side is the girl with the pearl earring and the view of Delft. And there's a Sarendam. Is that how we pronounce that?
Sarendam. Yes. Okay.
On the other side, like in the opposite wing. And the delicacy of the Vermeer paintings on the one hand and the thickness of the Rembrandt on the other, I associate, and I think when people talk about the Dutch Golden Age and they talk about the style of Dutch painting that, you know, you put Vermeer in that category, it's a very delicate brush, but Rembrandt is nothing like that. And yet he is the one, nobody paints like him. Nobody else?
No, and a lot of people try. I mean, of course, because he had all these students, a lot of people try. And as soon as you start looking at the imitators and the students, you start seeing how incredible it is and how he can make something ugly into something beautiful. And this is something that is completely fascinating. I mean, it's also really uncomfortable. If you look across from the view of Delft and the Vermeers and the Sarendams and the Maurits House, right, the other gallery right across from it is the Anatomy Lesson of Dr. Tulp, which is one of the great Dutch paintings, which he painted when he was only 26. That was intimidating to look at when I was 26. Yeah. I'm thinking, like, I'm trying to pitch some article, you know, like an 800 word book review, and this is what he's doing. but you know, I'm probably getting my book review turned down. But there's something, Rembrandt also can paint extremely finely, but it doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to be a refined looking subject. I mean, a lot of it is blood and gore, which I find, and so there's always that tension between the means and the, but you know, and Dutch painting is not one thing. I mean, there's so much of it and there's so many different styles and personalities that it's always fun to learn more about it.
Right. It's interesting that it seems as if he was such an outsized presence for all of them that they couldn't even try to quote him. Because it was...
Well, they did quote him. I mean, all of Dutch painting, it's like Shakespeare. It's not necessarily that they quote
a style.
Hamlet, but they might, but they say to be or not to be, for example. It's that sort of influence. And for me, it you know, when I was young and starting out, having that sense of possibility was meant a lot to me. And it didn't mean I was trying to compare myself to Rembrandt. It just meant that it gave me that idea that so much more was possible.
Right. And you do, you say this also, that you know that you're not putting yourself in the same category as these painters, but if that's what you're shooting for, and if that's the company that you're keeping in your own mind, that's going to raise right. the level of your work, whether you want it to or not.
Yeah. It's just like, if you read bad stuff, your writing becomes worse. And if you read great stuff, then it elevates you and it lifts you up. And this isn't so fashionable. I think it's sort of more fashionable to aspire to mediocrity. There's a lot of fake modesty that I think hides a lot of defeatism and depression, frankly.
I think that people also find it embarrassing to aspire towards, I don't know, gravitas. I think that's become sort of out of fashion. So you say that you want
to... Sontag writes a lot about that also.
Yeah.
She was often mocked for that. And she said, what, should I aspire to be mediocre?
But you also, you do have the greats in there and the people that were taught to think of as great, but you also have this capacity, which is a really difficult capacity for a museum goer to develop, to identify the people that you might not be told to admire, but you see something in them. And not in all of their work, but in some of their work. And I think it's a forgiving thing to be able to notice the not greats. And you dedicated a couple of chapters to people like that, I think, on purpose, I would guess.
Yeah, well, like, I mean, I guess the most famous one is Jan Leavens, who was Rembrandt's great friend of his childhood and who grew up with him. And they started painting together in Leiden in the early part of the 17th century. And there's all sorts of questions for why, I mean, this is just me as a young person thinking, like, why does an artist succeed and why does he fail? Like, what is there a formula? Because actually when I was young, I think like a lot of uncertain young people, and which is, you know, not just young people, everybody is insecure. I was quite fascinated. I was quite like, I wanted someone to tell me how to do it. I wanted someone to tell me, like, how do you not fuck this up? You know, Jan Leavens was universally acclaimed as the most talented painter of his time when he was a young man. And he kind of blows it in a certain way. So how do you try not to blow it? And I mean, is there an answer? No. But I think that's part of why I was also attracted to writing about lives of artists.
For him, you have this really harrowing sentence at the end of it, at the end of that chapter, which is that he must have known that he never became the thing that he was supposed to be. And he died knowing that, which is a question. Oh,
absolutely. I say that his tragedy wasn't not being Rembrandt, it was not being Leavens. And right. And of course people know this about themselves. I mean, unless they're, I guess, you know, some people I've known, not naming any names, but I mean, people who have done a lot of drugs lose this sense of themselves. And they get lost from themselves. But I think anybody who is really smart and has talent knows exactly what their shortcomings are. And either you work around them. I mean, one of the reasons I was saying where I went to college, I went to Brown because I was horrible at math and science, really just like completely hopeless. You know, I got C's and D's and I tried so hard and I thought, okay, I'm just not good at that. So I'm going to try to do the things I'm good at. I played piano my entire life and I loved playing the piano, but I have no talent for music. But certain people, and this is also true of artists, they'll keep trying to do something they're not that good at. I mean, Susan Sontag did this with her fiction writing, obsessively trying to be a novelist. And to the point where it was like this belly flop that everybody was like horrified by. But And it gave her something, but it also took away from what her real talent was. So that's a lot of the questions that I had. Like, what is your talent? How can you develop it? How can you make sure you don't lose it? It's very delicate, everything.
Has Leon told you the story that his favorite story about Susan in Fiction? Did he tell you this?
Oh God, I'm sure, but I can't remember. I've heard a lot of stories about that.
It's that she like came into the room once, they were friends, and she said, I realized that I'm actually a fiction writer. I'm not a nonfiction writer. And he was like, why would you say that? And she said, because in fiction, I always get it right on the first draft, but for nonfiction, right, I have to keep revising. So that means like exactly wrong.
Susan Sontag did a lot of drugs. She did a lot of amphetamines. And I think that's what you're hearing there. And people will say that's reductionist or whatever, but it is. I mean, one of the things that drugs do to you is take away your ability to gauge yourself for your own self, but also how others see you. So you start saying things like that. And this is something I've seen a lot of in my life. And I think that it is a challenge for artists, is how do you become who you feel you should be? Clarissa Spector says, vocation is different from talent. Many are called, but do not know how to go. And for me, I think that's maybe why you felt that you got to know me so well in the book, is that that was my question. You know, that I felt called to be a writer, right, and I didn't know how to do it. So, so I looked to people who had done it or had tried to do it and not done it, not and failed.
And these were the people who kind of shepherd you. I mean, over the last 20 years, these were the people who were keeping you company while you were discovering that about yourself. Okay. I've definitely asked enough questions. I want everybody who has questions for Ben to have time to ask them. So if you do, go ahead. You just have to unmute yourself and take the reins if you feel so inclined.
I can start.
Thank
if
you.
I may.
Okay.
So first an appreciation and then a question. The appreciation is just having read the piece on Rembrandt that you did on Liberties. I was in Amsterdam for the first time in August and saw the Night Watch, and you know, they have that replica that shows more of the canvas than you see now. I did not know the history of the canvas at the beginning and following World War II. That was fascinating to read about. It's not the center of your article, which is about darkness and blood, but it was moving after having recently seen it. I guess what I don't see in the writing, and I'm intrigued to read the book, you don't often place yourself in the museum and show us you looking at the canvas. And so my question is in part about, let's say, the difference between looking at Rembrandt and looking at, say, Vermeer. So this is very simplistic. I'm a pianist. I'm not an artist. But if I look at Rembrandt, it seems like I know where to look. There's so much dark. There, the light is telling me where to look, and the subject seems captured in a number of looks, but in that look. In Vermeer and in other Dutch painters, everything's there. You know, the early painting of the street scene that is in the Rijksmuseum, with the alley and the woman with the pail. There's so much where your eye could be drawn. And so part of looking at it is just, there are helpful things in the museum suggesting places you might cast your gaze, but it's a different experience to look at Vermeer and think about what one's seeing. There is light coming in from a place, but I'm not looking at the light necessarily. It's not just illuminating one thing, the whole the whole scene is illuminated. So can you say something about the act of seeing Dutch painting and it, how it might
differ? Well, it changes. I mean, I've been here for 20 years, you know, and so the impressions I had as a young person, just that tsunami that comes across you when you first discover these artists is so different from how I would see it, you know, when I was 25 and 30 and 40 and now looking at 50. There's something, but even today, I'll tell you something funny. I have, you can't see, but these are multifocals, not bifocals, multifocals. So I got these like about a month ago and I'm still sort of woozy and like falling down the stairs and everything. It's really a weird experience that I'm told is going to go away. But I went to the show that I mentioned today here in Utrecht and I looked at this interesting show, but it's actually the first time, because I've been away for a few weeks, that I've been in a museum since I got these glasses. And it is completely disorienting to look at it in these different ways, because I now have at least three, possibly more multi, I'm not sure how many multi it is, but if I'm looking straight at a screen, then this part falls away. And if I look down here, it looks different. And I thought that was sort of, you know, the experience of looking at things, it's all in the beholder. I mean, you know, everything you say about the light and Vermeer and Rembrandt, for example, you know, you can also almost always say the opposite, especially with the painters that have a big body of work. You know, I mean, Vermeer has so few paintings that it's hard to say, but you know, the real, like if you look at Halls, for example, who paints for more than 50 years that we know of. So it's just, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm trying to record my own looking and my own ways of seeing and how it's changed.
Thanks.
Chuang, you want to go ahead? Ellen.
Yeah. Hi. Anybody see me, hear me? Okay.
I can hear you.
Thank you, Celeste, for hosting this event. And thank you, Ben, for, I guess, your presentation. I've had the pleasure of reading your essay in this Liberties issue. And you were writing about Rembrandt, and you write in a way that someone with the art history knowledge of a first grader like myself can understand. One of, this part really intrigues me, and I hope you can comment more on it. I quote, "If Vermeer was a painter of light, Rembrandt was a painter of dark, or more precisely, of dark commingled with light. And in his work, the question of evil recurs more than in any other Dutch artists. So insistently that looking at his pictures is sometimes unbearable."
Yeah, because Rembrandt is an incredibly horrifying painter. And there's something that official consecration, I'm just writing this other piece about a Brazilian hero of this kind, who sort of became somebody on a statue, you know, and every once in a while, the guy in the statue gets down from the horse and starts talking. And what we know of Rembrandt's life is, you know, he was an incredibly, I guess you would say problematic person in certain ways. Today, you might say that, but the experience, I guess, for me of discovering that really humanized him for me, because it gave me a way to approach him in a way that I think when you have these incredibly overwhelming cultural figures, especially from another culture that you're kind of not too sure about, you don't really know enough about, you feel sort of timid in terms of making judgments or even responding to them. Once I started seeing that, I started seeing it everywhere, and I started not seeing it in any other painter. And so that makes it even more fascinating.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
Anyone else? I have a question. If no one else is going to ask a question. All right, I'm going to ask one and then you guys can think of one. Then in like every single chapter, there is like a plot twist or like a crazy thing you find out, which is like surprising for a work of art history. I'm not going to I'm not going to like give examples because I don't want to, I really feel like it would be a spoilers because there's so many moments when you're just like, oh my God, what? there's like one time when it seems you always seem like, you know, that you're showing us something crazy that you've discovered for yourself. There's one time when you're like, this completely brought me up short. But I'm just wondering if there were any like times when you were in an archive or talking to somebody and you suddenly realized something about this painter. I know what my favorite one is, but if there are any that were your favorites from.
Tell me what, I think you're talking about, are you talking about Clara?
Yes, that was one of my, well, not just her, although it's clear that you were super excited about her. My favorite one is from that chapter, but tell the Clara one, because she's like my favorite character in the whole book.
She's my favorite character. I actually have a picture of her. It's not in the one that you saw, but in the next pass, I got a picture of her looking sort of sturdy and not
as she
having
should.
A great time. Yeah, and she was, she's sort of large and in charge. This is a great story that there's a painter called Henrik Averkamp, who was a painter that you've seen pictures of. You might not know the name, but you've definitely seen it. Averkamp painted Winter Fun. He painted every scene you've ever seen of Dutch people out skating and having a great time on the ice. And I read, well, I was really interested in him, and I got the kind of classic standard book about him, which was from the 30s. It was from like 1932, I think. It's this big. And I thought, oh my God. And I started reading it, and this woman has this completely insane style. I mean, it's like unreadable, even by the standards of sort of century old Dutch art history. It's like really Baroque. But I kept reading. I was completely compelled by this book because I thought, like, there's something about this book. This is such a crazy book. Like, this woman is nuts. And anyway, I kept reading it. It was strangely compelling. And I realized at a certain point that she's an unreliable narrator. And it's kind of a hilarious moment. But the funny thing about it, that I knew there was some emotional thing about it. And what the emotional thing, it turns out, I mean, I don't think this is a spoiler alert because everybody knows this, but Averkamp was actually deaf. And I found out that Clara, the woman who wrote this book, was deaf herself. And so then you realize, oh, like you think she's talking about some, you know, some property deed from 1582. And actually she's pouring out this confession into this book. And it becomes incredibly moving.
Yeah, you build it up so well. My favorite thing in that chapter is that, and I think this is so crazy, just like, I think this is nuts. So everybody thinks that Averkamp just like really became quite bad in the end, like the end of his life. He was painting the same subjects, but they were just like so much worse than the earlier stuff. And that had been his reputation for, I think, centuries. And then it's discovered that he died before all of those bad paintings were painted. And this was his nephew who painted all of them. I mean, can you imagine like if somebody named Bello wrote about America, like, can you just...
Yeah. Yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah,
yeah.
No, so and Clara is the one who discovered that. So right. So she made a case for this painter. I mean, that's what you can do as a critic or as a historian, is you can say like, oh, this guy who you think was kind of okay at first and then kind of went downhill, he died 40 years before those paintings were made.
Yeah. Anyway. And you include pictures of both, so you see how startling the difference is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Celeste, I have a question for Ben. Can you hear me?
Yeah, but there is a line of questions. So
I'm sorry, I was away. Okay,
that's okay.
I yield.
Jen, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm a little hesitant to draw the subject away from Ben's current work, which I'm fascinated to read. I hope to read it soon. I'm a translator, and I was wondering what your path to translation was, because as I was reading about you before coming today, I understand that you've translated the works of Clarice Lispector and other works.
Well, so did you hear what I said about languages earlier in the, yes. You know, how I started studying languages? And I had acquired, by the time I was quite young and totally inadvertently, but I had you know, I knew a few languages by the time I got out of college. And then thereafter, you know, then I learned Dutch when I came here and all that. So, but my real love of translation came from Clarice Lispector, from discovering her when I was in college, second year Portuguese, and just thinking this was the best thing I'd ever read and how come nobody's ever heard of her, and becoming, as Celeste said, a little bit obsessed. I mean, I still work on her every day. It's been 25 years.
I think translators have to be a little obsessed.
You have to be. Well, good translators are. I think you can always tell the difference between good and bad is the people who are not quite obsessed. You know, it's like musicians who don't care if the note, if it's a C or a D, it's like, well, you know, but like real good translators have that sort of obsession, and they have the musical ear for it too. So I see another question.
Jay, and then Leon, and then.
Okay. Wait, I see.
Yeah, sorry, I had to get my video on. So this is also a little off topic. Thank you for doing this. I was just struck when you said, you know, the Netherlands are the country of Rembrandt, England is the country of Shakespeare. Are you tempted to try and fill in the blank, your home country, the United States, is the country of blank?
You could say it's the country of Whitman, maybe, if you wanted to be positive. You could say, I mean, there's all sorts of, I don't think the United States has a figure that's that dominant culturally. I think maybe if you talk about the language, we're also the country of Shakespeare because it's our language. And, but I don't know. I mean, I think Americans have a different, I mean, maybe America is the country of Hollywood, you know, in the way the Dutch is, you know, that's the American thing that went all around the world.
Or a Bravo, yes.
Or of Hulu, yeah. But, you know, if we're trying to, you know.
Right.
The right turn on red.
Which, as my father once said, I don't think it was an original line. He said it's California's only contribution to civilization.
That's an old Woody Allen joke.
Oh, okay. It had to be something that, yeah, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So,
thank you. Anna?
I think Leon was ahead of me by one interruption, okay. So I will yield.
Oh, you sure, Anna? Because, you know, I'm used to opening doors for ladies.
Reclaim your time.
I thought you were going to say, okay. Am I sure? I tend to ask very long questions. Please, Leon, ask your very long question.
Thanks, dear. Thanks. So, Ben, here's my thought. You know, I haven't read your book, and I can't wait to read it, et cetera, et cetera. But I've been thinking over the years about the way in which Dutch painting has been received and written about. And I find over the years that my view of it is changing a little in the following sense that obviously it represented a kind of revolutionary discovery of the quotidian as a subject for art. And you're right, sure. The phrase about the painting of anything is a very nice phrase. All the hierarchies collapse, the hierarchies of the subjects. But sometimes I find, and I want to know what you think about this, that the cult of the quotidian in Dutch painting, it's a little exaggerated in the sense that there are painters and paintings in which I find sublimity and grandeur. I mean, Rembrandt obviously was not a genre painter. So Rembrandt is in a class by himself. But when I look at Vermeer's Light, or even more precisely, his painting of air, which is, I mean, there is something about it that kind of triumphs over the homeliness of the subject. And so sometimes I think that people can get a little too complacent. The Dutch genre painters, they're so easy because it looks like our own
kitchens. And what I was trying to say. These people, you think that you see a girl with a pearl earring, but you have no idea really mentally what kind of world that person inhabited. And I write about
the quality of focus, of attention that the painter lavishes on
the lace maker.
Yeah, you know, look at that. I mean, You know, yeah. It's sort of like, you know, it's if God is in the details, etc. And there are a lot of details.
Yeah, but I think it's always, there's always, I mean, there's a great line from Max Friedlander who says about another painter, there's always enough going on to distract, there's always enough happening to distract you from how little is really going on.
Oh, nice.
And, but that's, I mean, there's also, it's very hard to read these paintings. People have been trying, and I do write in the Metsu chapter about how starting in the 70s and 80s, especially English and American art historians started just kind of adding up how much everything cost. They would go through and they would say, oh, that chair, you know, that's probably from Antwerp and that probably cost 12 guilders, whereas right. Salary of the average longshoreman was 2 guilders. I mean, it's that kind of stuff. And it, you just saw them kind of giving up on trying to interpret things.
But the secularism sometimes makes it, I think, a little too easy for modern viewers. It's sort of
The secularism is subtle in a way. I mean, you know, first of all the, as I write in the chapter on Rembrandt, all of the religious painting comes from Rembrandt. Nobody else did that. Right. And anything that did it was derivative of Rembrandt. And on the other hand, people think that we know these people. And right. in a way we do, and in a way we don't.
Anna?
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you so much. Benjamin, first of all, I'm so enjoying this. This is amazing. And you're saying things that should deserve their own salons. Definitely, I'm going to jump back to one of them that really resonated with me. And this was the question of your original escape from New York and this decision that seems like the correct one to keep learning, to kind of try your own boundaries, to reject the static life. I mean, I think that's a beautiful way of putting it, like basically rejecting the static for the aesthetic. My question would be, after you'd done that and you went to the Netherlands and you had this very, you know, novelistic life, how did your research into these exceptional creators, painters, writers, art historians shape your understanding of your own nonconformism? Was there something that surprised you? Was there something where you said, gosh, I was right. I was right to leave. Look at all these people who had also left.
Well, I think any artist or anyone who does anything, you know, like the sort of things that I was trying to do, you feel the tug, you feel the sense of rejecting what you're supposed to be, whether it's by nationality or by language or by family or by profession. And at the same time, it's quite scary, you know? So you think it's completely destabilizing to live in somebody else's language, as I hear you do as well. I mean, it's something that's very, it takes away a sense of who you are in a way that is really hard to anticipate when you first do it, because you think, okay, the car is red. Okay, the car is, I mean, it doesn't seem as deeply rooted as it turns out to be. And so I think that makes artists even more attractive as subjects for thinking about and looking at, because they're also almost always, there's not a lot of like, artists that are completely stable, normal people. If they were, they wouldn't have this need to create, which is always it's creative, but it's also a very destructive need. It consumes your health, it consumes your family, it consumes your finances, it consumes a lot of people around you because it's so destabilizing and so upsetting often. So I guess that was why my question of like, so you don't have a static life. Congratulations, you're so interesting. Okay, but like, meanwhile, like here, and like, there's an old Loretta Lynn song. I think it was written by Shel Silverstein, actually. I bet Leon knows that, called Here in Topeka. Does anyone know that? I'm the only one from Texas here. But
it's an art song, yeah.
Yeah, but you know it, right? But I mean, you know, meanwhile, here in Topeka, here I am sitting here like, with all these emails and all these bills and all that. I mean, it's quite terrifying. So I don't know, maybe I was attracted to it for that reason.
Elizabeth? Oh, you're on mute. Let me just unmute you.
Okay. I had a couple of questions. The first one that occurred to me was, I don't know your book. I did read two of the essays, and I really enjoyed reading them. I wondered if you had could say anything about icons and iconology in terms of portraits. You know, you mentioned Pompeii and the murals, if there was something along the lines of the development of art with the iconology.
Well, so icons, which, you know, I'm sure everyone knows, are the form in which Roman portraiture is preserved in the Greek Eastern tradition. And then if you go, if anyone's in Washington, you can go to the National Gallery and you can actually see these almost, you can actually follow them in this one gallery coming into Italy. And, but still as sacred portraits. And the thing is that you see in about 1340 is that these become secularized. So the first portrait, the first modern portrait, post-antique portrait, is in the Louvre, and it's a picture of John II, Jean Le Bon, King of France, which is going to be in my book, actually. I just paid for it because I really felt like it needed to be there, even though it's not Dutch. But Jean Le Bon is on this gold background. And so he's still in this icon portrayal. You know, they haven't yet figured out, oh, you don't have to have a gold background, a gold ground. You could put him in his palace. You could put him on a horse. You could put him with his wife. You could put him outside. But the first pictures that come from the Greek artists, and they come into Venice, and then they come into the cities in the Po, you know, all the way up to Milan, that happens about a century earlier, but it's quite a long time before people actually realize the potential of what that can mean for secular portraiture.
Mm-hmm. Hey, thank you. And the other question was about Hall's use of black. I saw an exhibit once, I don't know, remember where it was. I'm here in the Washington area, and it may have been at the National Gallery, it could have been New York, but they referred to his using 40 shades of black, which I thought was fascinating. I wrote it down. And I plan to use it, and I did use it in one of my poems, but Van Gogh keeps saying 27, and when I was trying to verify that quote, I couldn't find it anywhere. Have you run across 40?
I have, it's in the, no, there's a letter to Theo, his brother, that, and yeah. All those letters are online. I'm sure they're in English.
I found them.
In Dutch.
Yeah.
Oh, you did find it. Okay.
Yeah, I found them, but I got this 40 thing, and I needed that number to sound right in the line of the poem, and so I kept it anyway. But I wondered if you had run across it anywhere.
I don't think Van Gogh actually counted.
Okay.
So I think you're okay. You know, let's just say 40. You know, he said 27.
Thank you. Aloy Fisher.
Hello, hi, and thank you for making this. I just wanted to make a question, to ask a question to Ben, to push back a little bit on what Anna and he was saying, especially since he's the biographer of Sontag, talking about leaving the static life in terms of an artist. Because Sontag wrote a love letter to Borges, and you could argue that Borges had like the most static life for an artist in a way. And I would wonder, what are your comments on that in terms of living a life that is trying to make art, but at the same time being a little bit static by the norms of artistry?
Well, everybody does it differently, you know, I mean, that's why it's interesting to read about different lives. But Borges, you know, was also a foreigner. I mean, he had a sense of himself as a foreigner. Most of his early reading was in a different language. And you know, he famously goes off and dies abroad. And but meanwhile, most of his life, he sat in his apartment. A lot of people do this. I don't think you have to go to a foreign country to become an artist. I don't think you have to speak other languages or you know, move somewhere interesting. But that's why it's interesting to me, maybe to write about artists' lives and to try to understand, I guess maybe it just comes from my own desire to see how other people had done it. And what you find is, unfortunately, there's no one solution. If there was one solution and I could say, Celeste, to be a painter, here's what you've got to do. Here's like, I'll just forward you this email. Unfortunately, there's no such email. So everybody has to figure it out.
Yes. All right. Well, everybody, I don't know, you know, I don't know what the crossover is between people who are here because of Ben or here because of Liberties or here because of Interintellect, but there should be a 100% overlap between everybody who's a subscriber to Liberties and everybody who would read this book and everybody who would be a member of Interintellect. So buy the book. You can pre-order it. I sent the link earlier, but I'm going to send it again. I hope that you enjoyed this. It was so much fun. And I hope that you will come to future salons, which will be every month. And there will be an in-person salon in New York sometime this summer. So stay tuned for that. And if you have future questions for me or for Ben, you know where to find me, but I'll put my email in the chat. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks so much, everyone.